Chapter 30. Eutychus, Earl of Longford, peered through the crack in one of the wooden benches from where he waited concealed underneath a seating of the Queen's main hall. The hollow space under the benches reeked of old dust and an oily film that slicked the stone floor. Eutychus had no idea that such a space under the benches even existed, until Melchor Rains had told him. And how did a Cretesian know about it anyway? Eutychus had never given any thought as to what lay under the gallery seating on the few occasions he attended court as an observer. The triangle-shaped crack provided a convenient view of the hall, and, more importantly, enough space for the muzzle of a rifle. Thanks to the sympathetic Cretesian's information, Eutychus had the opportunity to gain an honest reputation and save the life of the Queen. It would be a feat that would dwarf the incident at Harwickshire and elevate him into a realm of popularity unrivalled by any of his peers. The name of Longford would shine, perhaps brightly enough to reach the throne. Somehow, the helpful Melchor Rains knew that his credit for Harwickshire wasn't completely deserved, that his title of hero was perhaps a bit of an exaggeration. How Melchor knew, he would not divulge, nor would he confirm who else knew it. Had the effeminate Cretesian hidden somewhere in the trees that day when that clerk, well, Baron Davon Carver, had shot the assassins down with such deadly skill? No matter. Today Eutychus, Earl of Longford, would prove his quality, and he had a Cretesian to thank for this opportunity to earn glory and renown. After Melchor's hints at the day of burning ball, the Cretesian ambassador's attaché had cornered him in the Tubury Gentlemen's Club and talked to him at length and at speed. Eutychus could sense his nervousness, and what Mr. Rains had revealed shocked him. Horace Clout, the ridiculous Cretesian ambassador whom everyone hated, had orders from his parliament to assassinate the Queen. At first, Eutychus couldn't take Mr. Rains seriously. The notion was absurd. The Cretesians were a poor, starving lot with barely a gun to share between them all. A brazen act of assassination would bring the wrath of Bittermarch down upon them. But as Melchor continued his reasoning, the picture clarified. The Cretesians were still outraged that nothing had been done, either in apology or compensation, for the butchery at Rontag. The Queen had not accepted responsibility for the act, and had rejected all evidences brought before her. As time wore on, the event had faded to the point that few in Bittermarch even thought about it. But across the border, Melchor informed him, the matter was far from settled. The Cretesians, apparently, had roiled like boiling oil over the incident, and after Ambassador Clout had sent his last missive to the Cretesian Parliament, explaining Queen Philippa's dismissiveness and inaction, the Parliament had sent one last offer, one last request for remuneration. Failing that, the Ambassador was to kill the Queen or return home in disgrace. According to Melchor Rains, the blustery Ambassador was not a man to be gainsaid or ignored. The Queen had disrespected him. The Queen had dishonoured him. If she did not accept Cretus's final terms, he would avenge the people of Rontag and his own wounded pride. Melchor had done the right thing, Eutychus surmised. No one at court would take a mere attaché seriously, and if Melchor went public with his concerns, his life might be endangered. So the Cretesian had confided in him, the Earl of Longford, son of one of the most powerful families in the nation, and Mr. Rains was forthright with his reasons for choosing him. He said that he knew Eutychus had a secret, and thus had insurance that he wouldn't betray him. Eutychus wiped the sweat from his brow. The space beneath the seats sweltered and stank. When the lords and ladies above him shifted, the benches creaked and moaned in distracting protest. He kept his gaze pegged to the crack. The ambassador's name had just been called, and he needed to stay focused. According to Mr. Rains, the ambassador's plan was to present the offer. If the Queen refused it, he would pretend he needed to retrieve a letter from his coat. Instead, he would pull a pistol. Eutychus smiled. He would drop the ambassador before he could even take aim. Hero of Harwickshire would be replaced with Hero of Belshire. His family's honour would soar. His own reputation would swell, and the fickle heart of Arianne Hightower would at last revolve around his. Best of all, he could leave behind that twinge of shame he felt any time someone called him a hero. Horace Clout finally strode into view before the throne. Queen Philippa appeared in ill humour, dressed in grey and staring at the ambassador so severely that Eutychus thought he might wilt. Melchor Rains flitted up behind Horace with his light-footed gait. He spared just a tiny glance toward the crack where Eutychus waited, and the Earl swallowed. This was it. His rifle, his heirloom, was loaded and had been waiting under the bleachers where the resourceful Melkor had stashed it for him. The early morning hour of the conference meant that the Earl had to retire early and without drink the night before. He had hardly slept, but as the ambassador launched into his tirade against the Queen and against Belshire in general, all the tired fog in his brain burned away. Eutychus brought up the gun and placed the muzzle edge quietly on the crack. Few sat in the seats above him, but he couldn't be too careful. Horace Clout raged and riled like an angry sabre cat while the Queen watched him utterly bored from her throne. Eutychus could understand the ambassador's frustration. The massacre at Rontag appeared to be the deepest concern of Horace's life, while the Queen acted like he was talking about crop rotation. Would Horace Clout really resort to killing her? Eutychus lowered his gun. A nagging thought in his head buzzed around and landed on his consciousness like a fly on meat at the market. Killing the Queen meant war. Killing the Queen meant the ambassador would find himself suffering in a dungeon before being drowned. Killing the Queen meant certain defeat and death for his countrymen. Why risk it? Horace began shouting, face reddening and finger stabbing at the Queen as if to prod her off her throne or poke her into action. Spittle frothed from his mouth. His entire frame shook, his well-fed and plumped parts shaking in fury. Eutychus brought the gun back up. It was as Melkor had said. The ambassador was half out of his wits. He felt cheated. He wanted revenge. He ended his long stream of fervent accusations with a final, "What say you?" shot at the Queen like a murderous strike of lightning. The Queen barely shifted before saying, "I will not grant your petition for this farce you have perpetrated, ambassador." Finger on the trigger, Eutychus took aim. The distance was less than 30 yards, and the ambassador was an ample target, but the slime at Eutychus's feet and the cramped vision of the hole complicated the shot. Would Horace Clout really do it? The ambassador stood rooted, the red of his face draining in disappointment, face slackening. Slowly the ambassador reached inside his coat, grasped something in his pocket and pulled it. Eutychus saw the cylindrical brown shape emerging from the coat. Eutychus sighted down the barrel. A shot to the head would do. He squeezed the trigger. The bullet hit the ambassador squarely in the skull, just above the temple, and he dropped. Screaming and oaths tore through the main hall. Eutychus pulled in his rifle and made his way toward an opening as high as his waist that led to a cluttered supply closet and then out into the palace proper. The benches above him squeaked and squealed wildly as their occupants stood and fled. With the rifle in hand, he passed into a hallway in the servants' quarters, face flush with his success and a grin creeping up the corners of his mouth. The Queen was saved. The ambassador's revenge had fallen as impotently as his threats. The name of Longford would rise in honour. One day, Longford would sit on the throne of the monarch he had just rescued. The shocked sounds of scurrying and low whispers thickened as he neared the doors to the main hall. The guards had entered, leaving the outer door unprotected. Eutychus strode inside, finding a tableau of people spread around Horace Clout's body, his head in a pool of blood. The Queen stood facing the doors, face turned down in a scowl. "Eutychus Longford," the Queen exclaimed. "What do you mean by coming in here with your rifle?" "I shot the assassin," he said. "I was informed of his plot and stopped him before he could do you harm." Everyone was staring at him now. Something was wrong. "Do me harm?" the Queen asked. Melkor Rains strode at him, powdered face livid, tears pooling in his eyes. "Murderer!" he screamed, and then, "I demand justice!" Eutychus kept his face even. Mr. Rains had informed him that he would need to react in this way to belie suspicion that he had played the informant to the ambassador's schemes. In a placating gesture, Eutychus laid the weapon on the floor and raised his hands into the air. "I assure you, Mr. Rains, that I only did what was necessary to protect the Queen. The ambassador had a pistol and was pulling it to exact revenge upon Her Grace." Mr. Rains really did appear upset and kept on his forward track, trembling with his pretended rage. "A pistol? It was a simple courier cylinder carrying an official document of grievance. This is murder. This will be war." Eutychus stared around the approaching man, his stomach sinking. There, next to the ambassador's lifeless hand, was the cylinder, a polished wooden container with a black cap on the end. From his vantage point beneath the benches, it had all the appearance of a pistol. His mind raced to his conversations with Melkor Rains, to the assertions and information the Cretician had given him. Creta's coming to war against Belshire was foolhardy. What would it take to get a nation of starving people with a fraction of Belshire's wealth and firepower to go to war? An unprovoked killing of their ambassador in open court. Mr. Raines had tricked him. But Mr. Raines could be interrogated, made to confess. The Lord High Sheriff would break his bones and flog the truth out of his scheming skin. Eutychus opened his mouth to explain, to raise the alarm, and point out the duplicitous mastermind of the crime. But nothing would come out. He looked down at the long, silver dagger sliding into his chest. He looked up at the chilling blue eyes of Melchior Raines. The assassin stepped forward, put his face close, and whispered, "Well done, hero of Harwickshire." And Eutychus knew no more. Queen Philippa sought refuge in her drawing room as evening slowly smothered the room in darkness. She had sent her servants and guards away and hadn't bothered to order the lighting of any candles or lamps. The darkness suited her, practically blinding her weak eyes, helping her stay inside of her mind. Not 24 hours ago she had thought that she had wrested control of the plots plaguing her kingdom from her enemy's hands, and with one bizarre action, Eutychus Longford had undone it all. Eutychus Longford? She could scarce believe it. The man, she knew, was no plotter. He hadn't the genius of leadership like his father, nor the cunning of someone like Horace Clout. But Horace Clout lay in the morgue with a hole in his head. He clearly hadn't been the mastermind behind Cretus's plot. It had to be someone in Parliament pulling strings. Horace's agent, Melchior Raines, was a member of the Fist, no doubt pushing Cretus's plot along, but was Horace's death a part of that plot, or just a random act of misguided heroism? The former, she believed. Someone had exercised leverage over Eutychus, but what that leverage might be, she hadn't decided. Her best reasoning concluded that someone wanted to force a war with Cretus, a war Cretus would lose. Belshire's military outnumbered and outclassed them to the point that any sane Cretesian general would know that an attack would destroy them, regardless of the provocation. Perhaps one of her own nobles had decided to force a war, but to what end? Cretus had nothing Bittermarch wanted. A soft knock on the door prompted her to lift her head and her eyes. A servant poked his head in. "Lord Ember here to see you, Your Grace?" "Let him come," she said, "and get some light, please." Philippa tried to rise, but failed. She had sat too long in one place, and the muscles in her back and legs rebelled against movement. Two more tries produced sufficient momentum to propel her upward, though she had to plant the arrow-asp walking stick firmly on the floor to keep from tumbling over. She needed dinner and an uninterrupted night's rest. Wine might be required tonight, something old and red and rich. Two servants bearing a lantern and three candles preceded Lord Ember, her old friend bending at the waist. She signalled for him to sit near her so she could hear him. He was a soft-spoken man, and her ears seemed to want a holiday too. They sat and exchanged pleasantries until the servants stoked the fire and left. Lord Ember's face betrayed the worry she had felt all day long. The House of Lords and the House of Light would be busy preparing for war when the sun rose.
"I thank you for your visit, Lord Ember," she said. "I hope you are well despite the unfortunate deeds of the day."
"As well as can be expected, Your Grace," he replied, "though you look fearfully tired."
"I am afraid and I am weary," she confessed. "I'd hoped never to see such days as these. I would have rather left war-making to my successor."
He nodded. "Understandable. Though I am gratified that someone as experienced and intelligent as you are is still around to lead us."
She wanted to laugh, but only a wheezing cough came out.
"There are many more qualified for war than I am. I've never had much fondness for military strategy, and my powers of discernment have failed to root out the headwaters of this strange plot against us."
"It will come," he said with his friendly, reassuring smile.
That smile had always cheered her. It had been there since her husband had died and had helped her through many seasons of distress. She liked Lord Ember for that. He saw his calling as one to uplift, and he genuinely tried to do it. She sat up, leaning forward on her cane, trying to get a good look at him. Something wasn't quite right.
Is this a visit of consolation and commiseration, or do you have some other matter for me to consider?
I'm afraid I bring strange tidings, he admitted, face fully giving over to the worry she had sensed in him earlier.
I am not sure what to make of it. At first I couldn't be certain if my eyes were deceiving me. It came on so gradually. But over the last week I couldn't deny it.
What, Lord Ember? She asked.
The eternal flame is shrinking.
Shrinking? Odd tidings indeed. Her brow creased.
You mean the tongues of flame don't reach as high? The light isn't as bright?
Well, both, really.
It would be like building a fire with 10 sticks of wood, and once it was lit and going, removing one stick at a time. It's like someone or something is robbing the eternal flame of its light.
How is that possible? Philippa asked, stomach clenching. Could this be related to the plot?
It couldn't be a coincidence that all of these horrible things were happening at once. Lord Ember shrugged his shoulders.
There is no precedent for this. From the time of Joris Pulsifer, there are no records or legends that report any diminishing of the eternal flame. It is as if something is slowly draining the life force from it.
Do we need to set a guard? Move it?
I can't imagine how a different location would make a difference, he said,
folding his hands in his lap.
I have already doubled the guard to ensure no one goes near it. It remains elevated high above the floor. No one besides me has passed prayers into it for at least 2 weeks, and I have forbidden anyone from doing so.
Philippa's sluggish mind struggled with this news. The eternal flame was the heart of Belshire's identity. That it should dwindle and die would deal a blow to the cohesion of her country. If the flame wasn't eternal, then what was it? What were they?
I should not have burdened you with this now, Lord Ember apologized. You have enough on your mind, I am sure.
No, she disagreed. This is just another thread in a mystery. I need all the information I can get. Please let me know if there are further changes. Any piece of information, no matter how small, might be the key to understanding what is happening to us.
Lord Ember bowed and left, and the Queen struggled back to her feet. She needed her bed now, and the wine.